Hello and welcome to the Technically Legal Podcast. This is episode 102 for May 24th, 2011. My name is Ben Snitkoff.
I'm Dominic Rabier.
And I'm David O'Brien.
This week we've got three stories for you. First, we're going to talk about Dropbox being accused of misleading its customers. Second, we're going to talk about Verizon and the FCC. And lastly, we're going to talk about Oh My God Facts and the ownership debate over its Twitter feed. So our first story is Dropbox. So Dropbox offers a service wherein you get a certain amount of storage on a cloud server that's also backed up on your computer. And they offer an encryption method, so you can keep your data encrypted on the server. And until recently, Dropbox's terms of service had said, I'm looking for the exact language. Okay, Dropbox employees are not able to access users' files, and when troubleshooting, they have access to only file metadata, such as file names, file sizes, etc., not the file contents. However, in April, in response to some inquiries, Dropbox changed the terms of service to say that Dropbox employees are not permitted to access user files. And I should mention that all files stored on Dropbox servers are encrypted. So the issue that I think the FTC was going after here is kind of interesting. So the FTC has governing power over principally advertising. They're the they govern whether or not people are conducting themselves fairly in trade. Hence the name Federal Trade Commission, rather. Sorry, now I'm reading this. This file is a complaint, not an action. Okay.
This was a complaint from an individual consumer to the FTC to investigate Dropbox. As far as I know, there hasn't been any formal actions taken by the FTC yet. If you go to the FTC website at ftc.gov, you can look up any actions that the FTC is taking, including formal inquiries. I think under their actions and complaints section, something to that effect. And Dropbox isn't listed right now.
Okay, but there was a complaint filed by a person by the name of Sohogian. Yep, so anyway, the nugget of this is that Dropbox was representing that their service, was representing their service one way when in reality the reality was different, and as a result, there are some questions as to whether or not their advertising was accurate and whether or not it was misleading. So, any initial thoughts from the panel?
Well, the method that they figured out that there was sort of some flaws in the security practices or the practices that Dropbox was using was pretty interesting. The deduplication of data issue, which is, I think, how this started. Apparently, some time ago in the last couple of months, Dropbox had a blog post which mentioned that they deduplicate data for purposes of minimizing storage space on their servers, and apparently is when you try to upload a file to Dropbox, it is able to determine, and I'm not exactly sure on how, and hopefully you guys can fill in some details, whether that file actually exists somewhere else from some other user on the Dropbox servers, and if it does in fact exist, it's able to, it then looks like you've uploaded the file very quickly. I think what clued a couple people into the issue was that they tried to upload really large file sizes, 750 megabyte files that look like they would be uploaded in a very short amount of time, just a few minutes, which really probably isn't possible given the average upload rates for most ISPs. And they started asking questions, and then Dropbox says, hey, we do this deduplication thing, it minimizes storage space on our servers. But the disconnect there between that and their security practices seems to be that then Dropbox employees have access to the contents of the files that you're uploading to the web servers.
That's interesting. It seems to me that that's the kind of thing that you could do with checksumming. That if if Dropbox has a checksum of all of the files that are on the server, and then before it uploads, it does a checksum on the file on your computer that you want to upload, should be able to match it with, some sort of hash of the existing checksums and say, oh, well, okay, it looks like we already have that, so we're just going to, instead of actually uploading it, do a link to Dropbox. Dominic, does that sound feasible?
Yeah. I mean, basically, they are running a hash of the file, effectively a checksum.
I guess then the question is, they would have to run the checksum on the unencrypted files because the encrypted files would be different for each person's encryption.
Right.
Okay, that makes sense. But even then, they could theoretically run the checksum on the local
But,
one before uploading.
I mean, it's not
So,
clear that they're using separate encryption keys for each user, actually. It looks like
right,
they
that's
might
the
be
second
using a single
problem.
encryption key for everyone,
That's
which
not
is more
useful.
troubling.
Right, and of course the employees would have access then, or maybe there's automated access then to the key or the keys. But one thing that was pointed out, I think right around the time that this complaint was filed, that is that companies could use this to figure out what files Dropbox users have uploaded to the system. And one example I heard that was pretty interesting was if the RIAA wanted to see if people were using Dropbox to illicitly store files in violation of copyright, they could try to upload certain files, MP3 files, say, and then if the upload doesn't go through and it's sort of deduplicated, and you can verify that just on your screen, then you know that there is at least one other user that has that file uploaded, and then you could formally make a request, file a lawsuit, try to have a subpoena issued against Dropbox to identify which user uploaded that file.
Yeah, although, I mean, if I rip a CD that I own and then I store the MP3s and listen to them by streaming off Dropbox on my iPhone, there's nothing wrong with that.
Well, the
Right,
RIAA would say differently.
remove
Yeah,
the
it's
ripping stage then. I buy MP3s off of Amazon.com on DRM free ones and then just stream off my phone. That should be fine, although, as you point out, the RIAA actually does believe that a single streaming off the cloud, I think it's the RIAA, some one of these agencies says a single
Yes, those
streaming to a
folks.
single user is actually a public performance.
Which, yeah, doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But, I mean, this could happen. This would be. So let's say all three of us put the same song in our Dropbox. One of those actually gets uploaded. The other two of them are deduplicated. So if, the three of us tried to access and stream that file, that would be streaming one copy of a song to three people. And that would be a much better argument for a public performance. I'm taking your stunned silence as a indication that I made a strong legal argument.
Unless, of course, they actually copy the file, and then just—I mean—but then the copying would be earlier.
Right. I mean, it's interesting either way.
And not every digital music file is treated the same or even created in the same way, so it's hard for me to understand exactly how they're scanning and being able to determine the contents of the file, and how that might differ if you use different compression rates with the various digital music files or digital audio files.
Right, in my mind, it was three exact copies of the same file. Yeah, and I wonder if they're checking for the files, exclusive of the metadata. Because if we had bought the file, each of us bought the same file off of iTunes, there's some data in the iTunes file that identifies who bought it, so that may cause the checksum to be different from the three of us. But I mean, I guess we're getting tied up in things that aren't, really the crux of the story here.
Yeah, it's true. I think the concerning thing is that if the RIAA wanted to do something like that, they certainly could. And just by knowing, if you follow the logic there, that somebody else has uploaded the file and that it's being deduplicated to the R on the RIAA's instance when they try to upload the file, then that can become the basis of a lawsuit, and that by itself could be expensive for any particular user that has to defend himself or try to remain anonymous throughout any kind of subpoena that gets issued or a request for a subpoena, etc. And getting back to the FTC portion of it, I think the implication there is that some users feel like the company was not totally forthcoming with some of their practices.
Yeah, I mean, which seems accurate here. If they amended their language to something that is, substantively different from what it was, it looks like either they're didn't draft it accurately the first time, or drafted it in a way that they thought was close enough, and then when somebody called it on it, they changed it.
So the actual complaint has a couple of looks like crypto researchers who apparently in their own public comments, aside from any comments that were included in the complaint to the FTC, they show some confusion on the basis of blog posts and comments on other people's blog posts. And so the complaint then points to these things and says, look, crypto researchers were even confused by the company's statement. So if they were confused, I would think that the average user would be really confused about what their practices were at the time. I don't know what the FTC will do about all of this, especially since the company has gone back and tried to remedy the situation by changing their terms. But you know, they still could go back and look into what happened throughout this period and maybe do a formal inquiry and determine how far back these practices actually went and what the terms of service and use were throughout that period.
Any last thoughts on this, Dominic?
I'll sit here.
David?
I'm good.
Okay, let's take it away. I guess Dominic has the next story.
Yep, our next story is about Verizon suing the FCC over data roaming rules. Back in April, the FCC approved new data roaming guidelines that basically said that cell phone providers need to share their data capacity. So say you're in Wyoming, and Verizon has coverage of Wyoming pretty decently with their 3G network, and you're a local cell phone provider, you're like, hey, well, I don't have money to put my towers everywhere, so I'd like to enter into a data roaming agreement with you, Verizon, so I'm going to make a contract, and I'll pay you some money, perhaps even every time people use your network, and I'm sure I'll pass that cost on to my customers, but that way my customers will get data coverage, 3G coverage, and I don't have to put out money for towers. And the FCC's new rules basically say that you should, that these companies should play nice and enter into such agreements at reasonable prices, so to speak. Verizon is suing the FCC because it thinks that the FCC doesn't have the authority to do this and shouldn't be able to do this because they don't think, and furthermore, because it doesn't feel that there's a need for this to happen. So first of all, the FCC shouldn't be able, can't do this in that it's beyond what the FCC can regulate, and second of all, it's not necessary at all because people are already entering into, between the carriers, they're already entering into these agreements without the FCC needing to get involved. Thoughts from the panel?
How bad are the fees?
Not entirely sure.
I've never been hit up with any of those fees, at least to my knowledge.
Yeah, I think most of us are with major providers like AT&T and Verizon.
Right, yeah, I haven't paid a roaming fee since, I don't know, or
last
late
two decades.
90s.
Yeah, 1999.
Yeah, last millennium. The FCC basically says that the record evidence supplied by carriers in the market shows that roaming details simply are not being widely offered on commercially reasonable terms. On the contrary, the record makes clear that some providers have refused to negotiate 3G or 4G data roaming agreements, have created long delays, or have taken other steps to impede competition. So voice roaming, which has been around since the late 90s, because we didn't really have data networks back then, apart from pagers, I guess, dear Lord, voice roaming is actually mandated already by the FCC rules. So what would happen is the small rural carriers would get voice roaming agreements and they'd be able to share with the coverage of the bigger carriers. But then, because data kind of was the hot new thing that came around after the turn of the millennium, it wasn't encompassed in those voice roaming agreements. So the small carriers would be like, hey, we want to share your data. And AT&T or Verizon would be like, no, we're not going to let you do that because our network's already capacity. We don't care how much money you want to give us. We just don't want to degrade the performance for our own customers. Or they'd agree and be like, yeah, sure. Yep, any day now. Yep, it should be working tomorrow for weeks and weeks at a time. I mean, this really it mostly impacts rural customers where you're going to see sort of small cell phone providers covering maybe a limited part of the a state even with their own towers, and then trying to get coverage for those cases when those customers go outside the area.
So the aim here is to increase competition in the market for data services?
Well, the aim here is to basically to permit small carriers to offer nationwide service without necessarily having to be a nationwide carrier. Take a small cell phone company, perhaps one based, let's say, in Kansas, just serving around Kansas City and in that general area. Like, if the customer wants to drive up to Nebraska, that company's probably not going to have its own cell towers. Right now, though, it can, because of the FCC regulations, it can get voice coverage from one of the major carriers by entering into an agreement, because they're legally mandated to do that. So that customer, even though he belongs to Kansas City cell phones, let's say, he can get coverage, voice coverage, up in Nebraska. The problem is he can't get data coverage because there's no towers of that company up there, and the voice coverage agreement is in effect, but there's no way to force the big companies to get data coverage. So basically what the FCC is trying to do here is say, hey, small carriers are good. We want these small local carriers. For a lot of people, these small local carriers are very much an economic alternative because their prices are generally much lower because they don't have nationwide coverage. But for those occasions when people some people don't necessarily travel a lot and mostly are just in the same general area, but for those occasions where they do go outside the area, they should be able to get data coverage, data roaming coverage, just like they can get voice roaming coverage right now.
Aha, I see. That makes sense. And I did find some statements from some of the companies after these rules were issued about a month ago. It looks like Sprint liked it. It says here that the FCC must be congratulated for taking this action, despite the opposition of the two largest U.S. wireless carriers who have lobbied against this pro-consumer, pro-competitive item. That looks like AT&T might not have been happy, and definitely Verizon wasn't happy. Comcast was apparently in favor of it as well.
Yeah, AT&T and Verizon have probably put out the most money in terms of nationwide data networks, and in some sense they have the most to lose in that other companies can just sort of piggyback on their technology. Sure, they get paid for it, but AT&T especially has had network capacity issues.
Although not as drastic and not as recent as...
and not in rural areas at all. Like, it's mostly New York and San Francisco that are basically were unusable for a while there.
Right. My understanding is San Francisco is still not great, but New York is very usable now.
Yeah. But does this exceed the FCC's authority? Because one of the commissioners, actually, Robert McDowell, the Republican minority on the commission, said that it basically is trying to expose these cell phone companies providing data coverage to common carrier rules that the FCC doesn't have rights to impose on them in this area.
I mean, I'm no expert in the limits of the FCC's power, but it seems like something that's within their, what they can regulate. They can regulate, communication over the airwaves and over wires, and seems to count.
I haven't looked too closely at the complaint in the lawsuit, but is it the argument something akin to data services are not within the authority? Is it the nature of the services that they're trying to regulate?
Say that one more time. I didn't quite parse that.
I was curious if it's because it's data services and not, say, voice services or however you might categorize the other services you can get on a wireless mobile device.
I honestly not sure whether that would make a difference. I mean, the distinction between data and voice from the consumer perspective is vanishing. But obviously, from a regulatory perspective, the difference is still there.
So the Section 332 2C2 of the Communication Act state in no uncertain terms that, quote, a private mobile service shall not be treated as a common carrier for the purposes, for any purpose under this act. So the argument is that this clearly exceeds the power, FCC's power, by treating it like a common carrier, saying that you have to carry data from these other companies. That's an interesting argument. I mean, I don't know, like I said, I don't know enough about FCC's regulations and how specifically they how they justified this to know whether or not it's actually ultra-virus, which is legal speak for outside of the FTC's power, FCC's power.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not much of an authority on these topics either, but I do know that the Communications Act does grant the Commission authority to manage the spectrum and establish and modify various licenses and conditions for the companies who use the spectrum in the public interest. And that authority has been used pretty broadly in the past, but you know, it could be that they've found something here that is a challenge on good grounding.
Yeah. I mean, regardless, I assume that Verizon and AT&T are going to do some sort of application to either the federal district court for the DC, for the District of Columbia, or the DC Circuit, depending on which route the which venue is the appropriate one for a review of this order.
Yeah, and there's a lobbyist group for rural cell phone companies called the Rural Cellular Association, the RCA. And apparently, Verizon has actually already entered into more than 40 data roaming agreements with RCA members, including 7 4G roaming agreements, which is Verizon's sort of argument. And I'm trying to click to see the list of member companies, but apparently they want me to log into their website before I can actually see the list of member companies in the RCA.
Haha, sucker.
And I don't really want to create an account, so. Any other thoughts on this story panel?
I'm all set.
Nope, but be interested to see what the FCC does in response.
Yeah, we'll definitely keep an eye on this suit. Oh my god, take us away.
Oh my god, okay, some facts. About the next lawsuit, of course, which is the Oh My God Facts lawsuit. Because it relates to the Oh My God Facts Twitter account and the omg-facts.com website. The case we're talking about is Deck v. Sparts. It was filed in the Eastern District of California on the basis of trademark infringement, false designation of origin under the U.S. code, and rescission of contract. Basically, there are two people in this that are seem to be the principal actors. We have Deck, who is the plaintiff, is a 17-year-old who lives in California. He was the person who originally created the OMG Facts Twitter feed. Basically, the feed publishes what he calls titillating and trivial factual tidbits about celebrities, pop culture, world history, and commerce. In the year 2009, he was able to get 300,000 followers and became the 18th most active Twitter trend. And he entered into an agreement with the defendant, Sparts, who is, I think, he's been associated with a bunch of other websites that have been created in the last. Apparently, what happened was Sparts entered into an agreement with Deck, and the details of the agreement, and for once, actually, we have the contract. It was actually published online, so we could do a little bit more in-depth legal analysis than we usually can with lawsuits that deal with contracts. The allegation is, according to the 17-year-old plaintiff, that Sparts had induced Deck to sign a written contract which was designed to misappropriate the plaintiff's intellectual property rights and pay him little or nothing in return. Some key clauses to the contract here. Sparts had created this company, and so everything is termed by way of the company as a defined term within the agreement. And the company agreed to pay Deck 30% of gross revenues, less 50% of expenses from a YouTube channel, which was to be created, of course, around the brand OMG Facts. The company was also supposed to promote the sale of OMG Facts t-shirts on the website and also pay 100% of the revenue from sales of the merchandise to Deck. And also, the company was to place an advertisement on the OMG Facts website to the plaintiff's personal YouTube channel for free. And in return for this, plaintiff, DEC, then agreed to render internet-related services as requested from time to time. He agrees not to change any passwords without the consent of the company, and agrees to reveal any password changes to the official OMG Facts YouTube channel and or the Twitter account. There was a little bit of a legal gotcha, or there was an ownership of content section in the contract which purported to assign any of the existing copyright in any of the works that had been created so far, and any copyright that would be associated with works that would be created in the future that relate to the OMG Facts Twitter feed and the website as well. But what's interesting here is that the contract doesn't really say anything about the website other than what I just read off before about what the both of the parties were supposed to do under the terms of the contract. And to be honest, I don't think it's a terribly well-written contract. It has very loose terms in some areas where you would expect to find more well-defined terms. It's interesting that the ownership section says nothing about trademark issues. And now this brings us right up to the lawsuit. The lawsuit is mostly about the trademark that's associated with the Twitter feed and the website, and that it seems that the way that the lawsuit is treating those two marks is the same mark. What also happened before this suit was filed was that Sparks went ahead and registered the trademark OMG Facts with the USPTO in January. This contract was only was set for a term of 1 year, and after that year, presumably Sparks would have had to renegotiate with DEC to get all of the rights to use the marks or continue to do the promotional activities on the website. The allegation here, though, also is about the contract itself, because DEC is a 17-year-old. He claims that he should be able to rescind the contract and bring himself back to where he was before the contract was signed, because he is a minor. It's also worth noting that the contract was signed by his mother, in addition to himself, and of course the defendant in the case, Sparts. Kicking this over to the panel here, it seems that there are two issues. Who has the rights to the trademark, and what exactly does the contract actually do, and does it have any bearing on who owns the rights to the trademark? Panel?
Well,
Yeah, that's a lot to take into account.
which is what makes this such a complicated lawsuit, I think, because there are a lot of factual allegations going back and forth, and Sparks has also put up a something of a blog post on his Tumblr feed, which we'll maybe talk a little bit about later, but he paints a much different story than the story that's painted in the complaint.
Incidentally, I'm now going to start a Twitter account. Oh my God, factual allegations.
So let's start with the contract issue, maybe. Do you guys have any thoughts on the ability of minors to repudiate a contract after they've
Yeah, I
signed into
mean,
one?
the traditional law is that after he reaches after you know if a minor enters into a contract and then reaches the age of majority and then continues to assert rights or continues to act under the contract, then he loses the ability to he or she loses the ability to get rid of the contract after that point. So, you know, while it wasn't re-execute, you know, if it wasn't re-executed after he turned 18, then, you know, it doesn't matter because essentially it was re-executed properly after he continued to act on under it. But in this case, you know, there's the agreement of the parent and guardian. You know, in some states you do have to, or you're at least encouraged to get a court to sign off on them, but I don't know if that's the winning argument in this case.
Yeah, I think that, well, first of all, California has a statutory section under the, I believe it's the California Family Law Code that seems directly on point to this issue, and it basically grants the ability of a minor to void a contract even after they'd entered into it if they are of minority age. And there don't seem to be very many exceptions that would apply here in this case. And I looked into the issue a little bit about having a parent be a signatory or a co-signatory. on the contract along with the miner if that has any effect on it. And it's very much a state by state issue. I don't think though in California there was at least one very recent California case that basically says it doesn't have any bearing on whether the a miner can disaffirm the the contract in the future or avoid the contract in the future, even if the parent has signed the agreement. So based on that, I think that there is a strong case here that Mr. Deck would be able to void the contract because he is a minor. Of course, this is just going on what we know in the complaint, so that there might be more facts that surface in the future, especially if, Deck was aware of the fact that this provision existed that allows him to void the contract in the future, and if he tried to perpetrate some sort of fraud, those are the types of facts that would affect whether that statutory provision would actually go into effect here.
Yeah, the agreement itself doesn't really talk about trademark issues very much at all. And that's essentially what this case is about in terms of who owns Oh My God Facts in terms of the trademark.
Right, and also what's interesting is that Sparks is the person, and I did look this up on the USPTO test search system. Sparks is the person who registered the OMG Facts trademark in, I think, just January of this year.
Right, but Deck might have common law rights into it because he had 400,000 followers or something before he even agreed with Sparts. And he's a contractor to Sparts, according to this agreement, which is kind of a really odd way of putting it.
I think, well, it's hard to tell if this was a standard form contract that was just slightly modified for this use or whether this was something that was drafted from scratch. I'm going to go ahead and take a guess that this was probably something that was used for something else and then modified to try to fit it to this use. And those provisions seem to just get at employer employee restrictions, whether you have to give benefits to an employee or whether you have to abide by certain state laws if somebody could be considered an employee under a contract like this. But what's interesting, I think, is in that ownership section, which is section 3 of the contract. Of course, we're going to put a link in the show notes on our website. It says that any documents, records, creations, including but not limited to written instructions, drawings, photographs, computer programs, notes, or memoranda relating to the business of the company, which are made by the contractor, and that's Deck as the contractor, or which come into the contractor's possession while engaged with the company to perform services, shall be deemed the property of the company. That just seems to talk about assets or things which were acquired by Deck during the period of the contract and into the future. It doesn't seem to sort of retroactively try to make a grab at any of the IP that's associated in the past. But then the next section reads that the contractor shall assign to the company the title and interest to any copyright in any existing or future works that relate back to the contract and the scope of the agreement.
So these are actually both pretty young guys. Emerson himself is just over, I guess he's 24 now, so he's pretty young. Just kind of an interesting
It's worth noting
thing.
that the Twitter account now has, I think, 1.6 or 1.7 million followers, and there's at least 300,000 people which have liked the website, at least according to the Facebook tracker that's on the OMG Facts website. So it seems to have a pretty good brand that's associated with it. The real complaint by Deck apparently is that he's only received a couple $100. Since the agreement went into effect last year. And honestly, if you read the terms that are within the contract, it is a pretty one-sided agreement. You'll see that all of the terms basically favor Sparks or the person who's the defendant in this lawsuit. They don't really favor Deck at all. And certainly it's troubling to see in the ownership section that provision which purports to assign the copyright in any existing or future works that pertain to the services that Deck was providing to Sparts. But assuming that the contract is voided or at least voidable at this point, you have to go back, I guess, to the common law rights associated with the trademark, and My recollection is that trademark rights basically become associated with a mark once the mark is used in commerce in connection with the relevant goods or services. So you don't actually have to register. As soon as you're using a mark with relation to some services that you're offering in commerce, then you have common law rights or common law trademark rights. So then, is using a Twitter account enough to establish a trademark, especially if the what you're doing is providing sort of a service of copy pasting facts or something to that effect, maybe rewriting facts and sending them out to everybody else? Or is the real point which in time which you're offering some goods or services in commerce when you set up the website and you're selling t-shirts or linking out to a website that sells t-shirts and other types of memorabilia?
Yeah, I think it's got to be the second one because, I mean, there's no commerce involved in just having a Twitter account. There's no way to directly monetize the Twitter account itself. I mean, you're offering a service, but you're not offering a service in commerce. There's no possible way to exchange money. I mean, but then you get the weird thing where if you sell the t-shirts, you have a trademark on Oh My God Facts as it relates to, clothing items, but if you don't consider providing this information for free a use in commerce, then you can never get the service mark of Oh My God Facts as a service provider of interesting factual tidbits.
Yeah, I mean, Emerson Sparks, we'll probably link to this in the show notes, has his own little take on this as well. Basically, he's arguing that, I mean, he's the one who's sort of, he's saying that Dex sort of got bored with it and didn't want to run it anymore, and then he's trying to take it over, but that he's the one who drove the vast majority of the growth, and he built the entire website and everything.
And what's also interesting, I think, about the contract is that so it's just about to expire, by the way, or maybe it even has already expired because it was entered into, I think, last April. So the domain name OMG-Facts was created in, or at least registered in January 2010. So that suggests to me that the website had already been created before the contract was entered into by either of the parties. So it's possible that some more facts might surface, or I think Sparks has already indicated that he will countersue in this suit. Maybe we'll see that there are some oral agreements that occurred between the parties at some time in the past. Something else that might affect the ownership and control rights, or maybe even the assignment of the trademark. But to my knowledge, I think when you assign a trademark, you generally want to have it in writing. If you might even be required by law to have it in writing for statute of fraud purposes and stuff.
And honestly, I'm kind of, I totally don't understand the appeal of Oh My God Facts. So, like, I'm surprised somewhat that so many people are following it. And from what I can tell, it looks like both Emerson and Adrian are sort of ruthless self-promoters, so to speak. So it's kind of ironic to see them clash.
Yeah, apparently Sparks has an entire company which manages a variety of web spaces that he claims generates a lot of traffic. So he seems to sort of be a serial website creator that, just to drive up website numbers, something along those lines.
Yeah, he started the site Give Me Hope, or Gives Me Hope, which is sort of like the inverse of FML.
Right.
But yeah, in terms of the, I mean, I think Deck is probably going to walk away with this one just because the agreement doesn't say anything about trademark. The fact that Sparks registered the trademark isn't going to help him in that Deck had really demonstrated a lot of use of it before the registration, although he didn't challenge the registration, but I think the window's still open because it's 5 years. Is that right?
Yeah, 5 years for uncontestability, I think. But I don't know if maybe one of you could tell me if the deadline is already passed to file an opposition with the USPTO. I think that's a much shorter window. I mean, regardless, you still have an ownership issue either way if you don't file a opposition with the USPTO or not. And just so the listeners know, you file an opposition when someone else has filed an application for a trademark, and you can basically argue reasons why the USPTO should not issue a mark on the basis of the application. But either way, you still have an ownership issue because when you file a application for a trademark, you have to assert that you are the owner of the mark, and you also have to note, I think, if there are any similar marks which are being used or any identical marks being used in commerce and who owns them. And you have to basically disclose that to the USPTO when you file. So I wonder if any of that was disclosed in the OMG Facts application. So any final thoughts on this or anything you guys would like to add?
I'm all set.
All set here as well.
Okay, well, on that note, we'd like to thank you for listening to this week's show. As always, you can find our blog and our podcast on the web at technicallylegal.org, on Twitter as @techlegal, and feel free to send us comments and story suggestions to podcast@technicallylegal.org. Signing off, I'm David O'Brien.
I'm Dominic Rabier.
And I'm Ben Snitkoff.
We'll see you next week. Take care.
Okay, now are we ready to go? Are your glasses clean?
Yes, all set.
We're recording.
We are recording.
Lock and load, people. Hello and welcome to the Technically Legal...